When Barack Obama signed the stimulus plan, he vowed it would help keep people in their homes.
We must stem the spread of foreclosures and falling home values for all Americans and do everything we can to help responsible homeowners stay in their homes.
But it turns out the banks aren't doing everything they can, and the administration may have to shame lenders into doing the right thing.
It's not too cool to be ridiculed, but you brought this up on yourself.
Less than 2,000 people out of 500,000 have gotten permanent loan modifications. The White House says lenders should be embarrassed. Is there a fundamental problem with the White House plan, though? Or are mortgage companies fiddling while Rome burns? Maybe they just make more money by doing nothing. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 30th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste. Also on the program, counting U.S. troops in Afghanistan and dollars in Dubai. This week's agenda is on pins and needles right at the start of the week. Also, the trouble with Tiger Woods. He's definitely off the fairway this morning and saying, I love you without financing civil war somewhere in the world. The challenge of finding conflict-free diamonds.
But first, Julie Gonzalez joins us. Julie's a Takeaway listener from Royal Oak, Michigan. Last March, she called in to tell us she was having trouble meeting her mortgage payments and that she'd applied for a loan modification. So, Julie, yes or no, did you get your loan modification?
No, I did not.
Okay, so why not?
The final answer that I received, well, actually, it was a difficult situation. It was my mother and I. But the final answer that we received from the bank was that we had too much equity in her house.
Okay.
Which didn't really make sense to me.
Your mother had too much money.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, Julie Gonzalez, yes. Stay with us. I have a feeling there's more to that story, and we're going to get those details in just a few minutes. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Police in Seattle say the suspect believed to have killed four police officers in a coffee shop ambush yesterday morning has been shot and is wounded or even dead. They've had a house surrounded for the past few hours where the suspect is holed up. Detective Ed Troyer with the Pierce County Sheriff's Department says the man's condition is unclear.
We don't know if he's still alive. If he isn't, it's going to be because he succumbed to the wound that he received yesterday when he was in the struggle with the police officer that managed to get a shot fired off him at him before he was killed.
Police are trying to communicate with the suspect now. He's an Arkansas man with a history of violence toward the police. Battle begins today in the Senate to overhaul the nation's health care system. So far, the 60 votes needed don't appear to be there for supporters, and one flashpoint is the so-called public option. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont weighs in on ABC's This Week.
If you don't have that public option, I think you're not going to have the cost containment we need. I would be very reluctant to support legislation that did not have a strong public option.
Democrats hope to pass a bill before Christmas, but senators from both sides intend to offer very challenging amendments.
Heading overseas, the White House says Iran is isolating itself after it announced it would build 10 new uranium enrichment plants. Iran is refusing to comply with the United Nations Nuclear Agency. And in Honduras, the ruling party candidate has conceded defeat to a conservative rancher in the elections. Turnout was high, which is seen as a victory for interim leaders who ousted President Manuel Zelaya in a June coup. Asian stock markets rebounded from their large fall last week with the UAE moving to contain the fallout from Dubai's debt crisis. The Dow may rebound as it opens at 10,309. S&P will open just under 1,100. So we're asking you, the federal loan modification program may not be working. And so what are you doing to meet the gap in your budget? What are you doing to stay in your home? Have you taken a second job? Have you made some budget cuts inside your house? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking more about one mortgage owner and her fight to keep her home.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
good morning. $75 billion administration program from President Obama that was part of the stimulus plan that was intended to help mortgage holders, homeowners, stay in their homes and stop the tide of foreclosures. That's according to the U.S. Treasury Department. That's what they say was the intent of the plan. That hasn't happened. The Treasury Department has announced that less than 2,000 people out of 500,000 have actually gotten permanent loan modifications. Less than 2,000. So they're going to start appointing people to monitor the actions of mortgage holders and see if they're doing what they were expected to do. We're rejoined now by Julie Gonzalez, a Michigan listener who applied twice for loan remodification, once for yourself and once for your mother as well, right?
Right.
And you didn't get them because you had too much money.
My mother, that's the reason that they gave her, that she had too much equity in her home and too much in her savings account.
Okay, and what was the problem? What was the reason you did not get your loan modification?
I never got an answer. I'm assuming that it was a credit imperfection, because one of the stipulations of this, you had to have really good credit. You had to have
but
a good
not
job.
Too much money.
Yeah.
We're joined now by Louise Story, New York Times finance reporter. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
Okay, so you heard what Julie's just saying.
Yes.
In one case, she was turned down because they had too much money. The other one, probably because there were problems with her credit. So let's return to the details of this plan. I mean, because it sounds to me like these were the kind of people that should have been helped.
Right. You can't win in this program.
Right.
It was supposed to help 3 to 4 million people avoid foreclosure. And, you know, what we're seeing now, new figures are going to come out this week. It might be in the tens of thousands who have gotten these. If that. But here's how it worked. They would look at your income and they would try to give you a monthly payment that was actually affordable based on your income now. Remember, a lot of people have seen their income go down. People have had salary cuts. People have lost their jobs, gotten new jobs with lower wages. So they were going to try to give you a lower amount of debt.
By reducing the interest rate, not the principal.
So they were focused on the interest rate. There is a way to reduce principal under this plan. However, the plan does not promote that heavily, and most banks do not want to do that, because if they reduce principal, they'd have to take down a write down these loans, which, of course, would hurt them in their earnings. So,
of course, if it forecloses, they have to take a write down anyway, right?
It could be. It depends how the sale goes. Right. So, but the focus is on reducing interest, which only does so much. The other focus is on getting people into standard mortgages. Remember, a lot of people had
30-year fixed,
backed by Fannie. You know, a lot of people had these exotic ARM loans where the rates would go up after a few years. So they were trying to get people into plain vanilla mortgages. But the program did not anticipate a lot of the problems that would happen this year, such as more people losing their jobs, and you're required to have an income to get one of these modifications. Mm. So a lot of people haven't even been able to get into the trial part of this program.
Okay, so Julie, let me ask you, through this program, if they had adjusted both your interest rate and your mom's interest rate, would that have helped you?
That would have helped us a lot.
Okay,
that would have helped us a lot. I'm behind on my taxes right now. It would have allowed me to just, you know, be paying the same amount or a lesser amount, and I'd be current on my taxes, which would be great for me. As a small business owner, I'd lost that much income. So.
Okay, so Louise, many people say this is, as you said, doesn't help because it doesn't reduce the principal, but in Julie's case, it would have helped. So explain to me, why would mortgage companies not be doing this? I mean, they're going to lose money if the house forecloses, right? Is there not a natural incentive to try to keep people in their homes?
So the interesting twist on this is the parties who are handling it are the mortgage servicers. Those are an intermediary. They interact with the borrower, but they often do not own the loan. Okay.
Right.
So the administration's working with these servicers. And actually, servicers can make more money off of your mortgage if it's in delinquency for a long time. They get to jack up the fees, and actually the amount of money that they can make from the administration's paying servicers to do this.
Yeah.
Sometimes pales in comparison to the amount.
They're like $1,000.
They can get $1,000 a year for up to 4 years. And you know, $1,000 a year, $4,000 potentially, is peanuts when you have a really big loan. And so for the servicers, they can actually make more money over a longer period. The other thing that's in this test that people don't look at is there's a net present value test. And I think it sounds like this may have affected Julie in Michigan, where they have to evaluate whether they can make more money by modifying your loan or by pushing it into foreclosure. And I haven't seen the details of her loan, but if they told her she had too much equity in the house, it could be that they could make more by foreclosing on her house because there's so much equity there, they would get to take over. So because she's paid off so much of her loan and been a quote-unquote good borrower, she may have been put in this situation.
Julie, are either you or your mother in danger of losing your home?
I'm closer than she is, but I just, you know, cut back everything and make it happen and make the payment and then don't make other payments. So, I mean, I'm trying to hold on to my house for whatever, you know, whichever way I can. So I guess, you know, I guess if it got any worse than this, then, yeah, I would be in danger of losing my home. And if I don't pay my back taxes in time as well.
Louise, I mean, you can hear kind of the pain in Julie's voice there. And I think that's the kind of, it sounds like the White House is hoping to use stories like Julie's to, as they call, embarrass these lenders into doing what's right. What does this mean when the Treasury Department talks about shaming the lenders? What does that mean?
Well, the problem is that talk sometimes does not go as far as action. And if the White House does this, you know, maybe they'll shame some lenders, but it could be that this program is not designed in a way that will really help people like Julie. And it is. It is really
horrible.
Seems
like it's not serious. I mean, you can't just shame people. I mean, how does the federal government get banks to lend? That's the fundamental question. Yeah. They haven't even addressed it.
They haven't addressed it. And the banks are in a tough spot, of course, because they're still hobbling along. Only a year ago, we bailed them out. And if you have them take too many losses, they could be in trouble again. And also at risk here is the entire housing market, because a lot of economists say if you don't keep the rate of foreclosures steady, the housing market won't recover. And since March, we've had 1.5 million new loans go into delinquency, which is way outpacing any little few thousand modifications we've got here. So we've got a really growing problem for more people than just Julie.
Okay, so Julie Gonzalez from Michigan, in just the last few seconds, can you tell us how long do you have? Do you have 6 months for the White House to redo this program?
I'll definitely try it again. But my mother already went ahead and she just paid for a regular refinance, and just to lower her rate 1 point from 6 to 5. So, you know, that's helping her out a tiny bit. But I guess I would try it again, but I just don't know that it's going to happen, because the other problem is that, you know, you owe as much as you – or, I mean, your house isn't worth enough.
Yeah, you're upside down.
On what you owe, which is another problem with this program.
Okay, Julie Gonzalez is one of our listeners from Royal Oak, Michigan. She's struggling with her loan there. And also thanks to Louise Story, New York Times finance reporter. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
The Senate will debate health care today. Expect some serious horse trading over the next few days. Earlier, we heard the views of Senator Bernie Sanders, who says he wants a strong public option. On the other side of the aisle, Senator Lindsey Graham wants a cheaper bill.
$2 trillion spending package on health care, $2.5 trillion in the second 10 years, will make premiums go up because taxes go up to pay for it, and we'll never cut Medicare benefits to make it work, nor should we.
Senator Lindsey Graham spoke on ABC's This Week. Police say they're still trying to communicate with Maurice Clemens, the main suspect in the Tacoma coffee shop slayings of four police officers yesterday. Police have been surrounding a house in Seattle this morning. Clemens is thought to be injured or even dead inside the house.
Overseas, the trial has opened in Germany of John Demanyuk, the elderly Ukrainian-American man accused of helping to murder almost 30,000 people at a death camp during the Second World War. The case is likely to be Germany's last big Nazi-era trial. And Serena Williams has received the highest Grand Slam fine ever, 2 years probation for her U.S. Open tirade. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, Tiger Woods. Was it an honest accident or a domestic dispute?
Hey, you want that to go?
So our first news takeout concerns the Tiger Woods story, which broke over the weekend. Ed Wanambwa, senior editor of African American Golfers Digest. I have to figure this is a pretty good week to be a subscriber to African American Golfers Digest. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
This has got to be like a huge, you know, DEFCON 5 story for your publication. What do we know at this point?
Well, we simply know at this point for sure, without speculating, that Tiger Woods was involved in a traffic accident early, I mean, the day after Thanksgiving, was that like Friday morning, about 2:25, he hit a fire hydrant, ended up crashing his 2009 Cadillac Escalade, and his wife eventually came in and took him out of the car.
And because of the circumstances, the details, there's all kinds of speculation, and Tiger Woods is only fueling that by refusing once again yesterday to talk with Florida Highway Patrol officers about the incidents. We can't talk about sports without having Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, with us. And, you know, it seems to me this broadly is a story about a role model and a celebrity and, you know, the cost of not coming clean right off the top. Ed, would you agree that Tiger Woods is a role model?
He definitely is. I mean, he has millions of kids look up to him, as well as, you know, the public. I mean, he's arguably the most recognizable, you know, name and face in sports.
And is his brand,
Tiger needs to come clean. His camp just needs to come out and address this issue.
Morally or not, Ibrahim Abdelmateen, is his brand in danger if this goes on for, you know, a couple of weeks?
Well, he burst onto the scene as a smart, talented, family-oriented guy. He's become an international superstar. He's in the league with, like, Derek Jeter, Roger Federer, Michael Jordan. And it's similar to finding out that some of these, you know, well-known players, like Magic Johnson, when he said he had AIDS, and Jordan when he said he gambled. It's not so much that what happened is so terrible, because we don't know, but it's a chink in his armor. It's a chink in that sort of aura around him that makes you wonder what's really going on underneath the surface.
But a lot of people are going to wake up this morning and say, ah, who cares? And we are asking for our listeners to weigh in. I mean, do you care about this? What's your speculation? Do you have a theory on what happened with Tiger Woods? And do you believe he's a role model or just another celebrity? You can reach us at 878-8MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. What is unique about the Woods story here, Ed?
I think what's unique about this story, again, is that Tiger's always been squeaky clean. You know, you've never had any allegations or rumors about anything going on, and then all of a sudden have such a strange occurrence. You know, I think the police report said that Tiger was in and out of consciousness, laying on the ground, and you know, that type of thing. So I think you're absolutely right. There is a chink in his armor now.
I have a question, Ed. This is Ibrahim.
Yes.
Does the silence create this confusion that perhaps Tiger was always known as being mentally sharp and really focused, and that's how he won? And this past year, he didn't win any majors, and he had trouble putting. Could you connect some of the dots between this incident and what happened on playing golf last year?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, Tiger goes as his putter goes. If Tiger's putting well, he's going to win. I mean, because, you know, he's such a great escape artist from, you know, his erratic driving, but yet he's able to get the, you know, get it on the green in regulation, and if he's putting well, he wins. I think there's some things going on in Tiger's personal life. I think he's evolving off the golf course, and this incident is indicative of maybe what's really going on with the private Tiger Woods, not the public person that we see.
Ibrahim, I have to ask you, does this kind of mean that golf has stepped up to a new level? I mean, this Tiger has kind of made golf into the kind of thing where a scandal for Tiger is like the same level as the scandal for, like, Magic Johnson, which you can't imagine with golf stars of the past.
And I know that, and Ed would probably agree with me, but golf would literally not be in its place right now, the financial position it's in,
absolutely,
the notoriety that it's in, without Tiger Woods as the main star. So I think that having Tiger go through something like this, maybe he'll come out of this process and people will love him more and pay more attention to golf.
Well, let's see. Ed, I mean, you covered this for your career. I mean, does anybody care about Greg Norman's traffic record or his domestic relationships?
No. I mean honestly,
to put it plainly.
I mean, Tiger is the face of golf. Tiger is, you know, he's made purses go up. I mean, other golfers should send Tiger a check at the end of the year.
And
you know, because he's made golf a mainstream sport now, and now the idol, the face of golf, has a chink in his armor. I mean, he's proved that he's human.
Well, it gets back to the whole brand issue, Ed. I mean, a lot of people are going to wonder, why was he in an Escalade and not a Buick? I mean, he's the spokesman for Buick. He turned that company around, literally. I mean, there are all kinds of issues here.
Yeah, I mean, Tiger, I mean, I'm pretty sure that the Nike reps and the AT&T people were on the plane as soon as they heard about this. they were down in Windermere trying to find out exactly what's going on. And I think Tiger's making a mistake by not coming out and just saying, hey, this is what really happened. Because now he's leaving it up to speculation.
So like ours.
He's making us guess what happened.
So please, Tiger, come out and tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you know, I know his publicist, Glenn Greenspan, who used to work for Augusta National. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that him and IMG, they're going to be very tight-lipped about what's going on, but that only fuels the fire.
Well, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, let's make this the final question in this segment. You know, and it's a sensitive question to ask, is the fact that Tiger Woods is essentially a solo African-American character in the sport of golf, does it raise the pressure on him as a role model here and make this a difficult story more than it would be for another player?
I think it without a doubt, it raises the question because he is the only African-American, the highest profile African-American in the sport, just like a high profile African-American politician, entertainer. Tiger Woods is subject to more scrutiny, and so there's definitely going to be people that are looking for him to fail.
Well, great discussion. A lot of people are having it around the country this morning. Ed Winambwa, senior editor of African American Golfers Digest. Thanks again, Ed.
Hey, you're welcome, John.
And thanks for that takeout from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, of course, the Takeaway sports contributor. We're asking for your calls. What do you think about this subject? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up this morning, the week's agenda, and we're going to take a look at two big issues that are shaping the agenda. But first, let's take a look at the news stories we're following this morning at the 30 minutes after the hour. Police in Seattle say they are trying to communicate with a suspect believed to have killed four officers in a coffee shop ambush yesterday morning. Police say that the suspect has been shot and is wounded, possibly even dead. They've had a house surrounded for the past few hours where the suspect is believed to be holed up. The health care battle gets underway in the U.S. Senate today. The Democrats need 60 votes. Republicans are unified in their opposition.
Heading overseas, Iran is declaring it will build 10 new uranium enrichment plants and will refuse to comply with the United Nations Nuclear Agency. Republican Congressman Tom Franks tells Fox News he wants President Obama to take a tough stand with Iran.
I truly believe that if this president's policies of appeasement and indecision continue, it will mean the gravest of consequences for American national security and peace in the world. And Iran is just one aspect of that.
The White House is using Tehran's declaration to rally international support for new sanctions. President Obama will announce a campaign today to pressure lenders to lower mortgage payments for struggling homeowners. Part of that strategy is expected to use some old-fashioned name and shame tactics to get financial institutions to renegotiate loan payments as they are now required to do. There were more shoppers out this holiday weekend, but they spent less than they did last year. According to the National Retail Association, almost 200 million Americans hit the malls this weekend, spending an average of $372, and the overwhelming majority used cash. Only 26% pulled out the plastic. Serena Williams is going to be coughing up some money by check. The tennis star has been hit with the highest Grand Slam fine ever and a two-year probation for her tirade at the U.S. Open. And who's the most influential conservative voice in America? A new poll conducted by 60 Minutes and Vanity Fair says it's Rush Limbaugh. The radio host was picked by 26% of those who responded, followed by Fox News Channel's Glenn Beck, former Vice President Dick Cheney, and then Sarah Palin. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective. What's going on?
So on this Monday morning, the agenda is going to be set by two events early in the week. The financial debacle brewing in Dubai is roiling the derivative markets and bank balance sheets all over the world. And the Obama administration is finally going to roll out a strategy for the war in Afghanistan. We were joined earlier this morning by Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Nick Childs, defense and security correspondent for our partner, the BBC. We asked Marcus Mabry about the concern over a possible default of at least $60 billion of debt by Dubai and its subsidiary, Dubai World, and whether sovereign oil wealth will help.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the problem is Dubai is one of seven United Arab Emirates in this federation, and they don't have much oil to speak of. Abu Dhabi, which is the richest and largest by far of the Emirates, they actually have tons of it. And if Abu Dhabi were willing to say, we're going to stand behind all that debt completely, $60 billion, which is mostly Dubai World, which is the kind of investment
right.
vehicle of the Emirate of Dubai, then it would be fine. But Abu Dhabi hasn't necessarily sent those signals, and the market's waiting for that. what we're really talking about here is not just Dubai, which is, you know, again, $60 billion in debt. It's largely kind of real estate to build, you know, the island shaped like a palm tree and the island shaped like the world.
Crucial matters for the world.
Exactly.
I mean, really important
deep
things
stuff.
That
exactly.
we need to do. Yeah.
But it was the most profligate of kind of all the big spending countries and companies even during the boom. That's not the issue, though. The issue is really a question of confidence. And what we're watching for this week as Wall Street opens is we're watching to see is will there be a crisis of confidence, the kind we had back in September of last year after Lehman went bankrupt and everyone suddenly thought, oh, my God, I can't trust any money being out there at all. I'm going to pull back. That's what happened. That's what we're afraid of. And we'll have to see if it happens this week.
Another sign that in this interlocked economy, that crisis of confidence can come from almost anywhere.
That's right. It's a global financial system.
Nick Childs, a BBC defense and security correspondent. Barack Obama is going to roll out his Afghanistan strategy. What are NATO allies looking for from the president? And what do you expect roughly 30,000 new troops, which is what we believe is going to be announced, is going to mean for the battlefield?
Yes, John, I think it will be around 30,000. That seems to be the number people are talking about. I think it'll be a mixture, really. It'll be some for combat and some for training. And that is the key in terms of training the Afghan forces, because most NATO allies, and I think the president as well, will say, you know, that's the way forward, but it's also ultimately the way out. And that is an element of what people are looking for. They're not looking just for numbers, but also, the overall strategy, what the troops will be used for and how the process will move forward. And of course, NATO countries have been sort of hanging back saying, we want the president to show the lead first and then we'll see what we can do. Well, I'm sure the Americans, once Mr. Obama has made his pitch, will turn around to them and say, okay, it's over to you now. What are you going to do?
Well, indeed, Nick. Listen to this. I mean, there's kind of a vicious circle here. NATO waiting for the U.S., the U.S. wanting NATO to take more responsibility in Afghanistan. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. He's an independent. He's a bit of a lefty, but I think he represents the American position fairly faithfully here.
I've got a real problem about expanding this war where the rest of the world is sitting around and saying, isn't it a nice thing that the taxpayers of the United States and the U.S. military are doing the work that the rest of the world should be doing?
So what is NATO likely to do to upgrade its commitment?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, is traveling to Brussels for a NATO foreign ministers meeting later in the week, and she'll be saying, you know, essentially, we've done what you've been waiting for. We would like to see several thousand, probably, extra troops from NATO. That's going to be a hard ask, I think. But the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said he thinks maybe 5,000 is possible. It may happen over time, but it'll probably be in dribs and drabs. The Germans, for example, who are being asked to come up with some more, probably aren't going to make a decision until January, February next year. But clearly, I think the message will be this is a crucial test for NATO as well as it is for the United States, so everyone has to join in.
Nick Childs, BBC defense and security correspondent. Thanks for that. He joined us from London, England. So Hillary Clinton has her work cut out for asking for troops over in NATO. She's going to be on Capitol Hill along with Defense Secretary Gates trying to explain the administration's strategy, and the health care debate begins this week. Marcus?
This is decision week for the administration. It's funny, you know, they're going to end the year the way they began it, which was with a big bang of policy announcements and problems. Everything from jobs this week, health care, Afghanistan, Iran's intransigence. This is going to be a week of big decisions.
You mentioned jobs. The Jobs Summit takes place this week, almost crowded out by these other huge issues. And this week, the numbers for November, the unemployment rate for November, is going to come out on Friday.
That's right. We would not be surprised if we saw unemployment, which already at 10.2%, the highest since the 80s, tick up maybe a point or a 0.0% or something, from like 10.2 to maybe 10.3. We're in a recovery. That kind of doesn't matter because people don't feel it. It feels like you're in trouble. You might lose your job. Paul Krugman has a really kind of stinging column this morning in the paper talking about how we're actually, if you're unemployed, it's going to take you longer to find a job now, more than 6 months, than at any time since the 1930s. Krugman goes on to call for an emergency jobs program. That will be the debate this week. Can the country afford an emergency jobs program, or should the administration do more to make it easier for business to hire?
And does a jobs summit take the sting out of 10.3% unemployment in the middle of the holidays? Well, let's contemplate that for a moment. But you had a story you wanted to talk about here. In Switzerland, the nation that brought us the cuckoo clock passed a ban on Muslim minarets on mosques over the weekend.
You know, minarets are the towers that are often used for calls to prayer. In Switzerland, they're not,
beautiful,
because Switzerland doesn't allow any, you know, noise pollution. So they don't even do that. There are only four mosques in Switzerland with minarets. This is really about integration, European fear of Islam, and it's going to play out a lot, I think, in the continent this week.
Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and there's your agenda. Coming up, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen buries the lead. Nothing about Tiger Woods. He's going to talk about how hard it is to find a conflict-free engagement diamond. Beth Koblenner joins him to tell us how difficult that actually is. Ibrahim, what gives? This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. An announcement from Iran yesterday has a lot of analysts scratching their heads and wondering what kind of game are they playing. Iran says it will not comply with the demand by the United Nations Nuclear Agency to stop work on a once-secret nuclear fuel enrichment plan. But that's not all. They've also said they're going to build 10 more such plans. Joining us now is David Sanger, The New York Times chief Washington correspondent. David, is this a real threat here to build 10 more? Is Iran able to do that?
Well, the threat's real, but whether the capability's real is another question. You know, when you think about it, they've been building the Natanz plant, the main enrichment plant that we frequently see in news photographs and so forth, since early this decade. And right now, they've got about one-sixth of the number of centrifuges, these machines that are used to enrich uranium, installed that the whole plant takes. And this secret plant that was revealed 2 months ago has been under construction for at least 3 or 4 years. So if they wanted to build 10 more, it's going to take quite some time, maybe decades.
And is this just Ahmadinejad pounding his chest? Is he just trying to prove to his own countrymen that he will not bow to Western pressure?
Well, I think there's an element of that. But, you know, there was something in the announcement yesterday that I suspect the U.S. government finds more worrisome. You'll remember, we've talked about this on this show before, that the Iranians reached a tentative deal, which they later backed out of a few months ago, to ship a good deal of their fuel out of the country, have it enriched by the Russians and made usable in a medical reactor that is in Tehran. They balked at that, and yesterday Ahmadinejad said that they were studying a plan that would enable them to go enrich this uranium themselves. The reason that's worrisome is that it would begin to take their fuel and move it much closer to weapons-grade capability than it is currently.
So at this point, I mean, there's already sanctions against Iran. What else does the West or the United Nations have in its arsenal to threaten Iran with?
Well, you've raised a very good question. There are three United Nations Security Council resolutions that have been passed against Iran since late 2006, and each one of them has had escalating sanctions, and none of those sanctions have changed Iran's behavior. So if President Obama wants to go to the next step, he would need truly crippling sanctions, and that means really one of two things. One is stopping the import of refined gasoline into Iran. It exports a lot of oil, but it doesn't have a lot of refining capability for its own needs. And the second possibility is to target those companies that do business with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which runs the nuclear program and is a big centerpiece of the Iranian economy. But the opportunity for backlash, including military backlash, is fairly high from those.
Okay, David Sanger is the New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and the Challenges to American Power. He's talking about an announcement from Iran yesterday. It's not only not going to comply with demands from the United Nations Nuclear Agency, but they say they will build 10 more nuclear fuel enrichment plants. We'll see how that plays out and how the United Nations will respond during the course of this week.
We'll be right back.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Diamonds are forever, but the diamond trade finances conflicts around the world. How do you say I love you with a guilt-free diamond? We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But right now, here's a check of leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Military experts are looking forward to President Obama's announcement on Afghanistan tomorrow evening. The leading Senate Democrat on military matters says the president will need to show how more U.S. troops will help increase the number of Afghan security forces. On CBS, Senator Carl Levin was asked how he would define mission accomplished in Afghanistan.
Greater security for the United States, but it's the Afghans that have got to succeed, and we've got to help them succeed.
Senator Levin says the president will need to make a compelling case during his national address on Afghanistan tomorrow. The president will speak from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point.
Police in Seattle believe a suspect in the shooting deaths of four police officers may be wounded and perhaps dead. They've been trying to communicate with Maurice Clemens, who they say was holed up in a house overnight. The four police officers were sitting in a coffee shop in Tacoma on Sunday morning when a gunman opened fire, killing all of them. Looking ahead, the healthcare debate starts today in the Senate. The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick is here to explain it to us. We are looking for them to introduce amendments tomorrow, and there'll probably be a lot of them, right, Todd?
Yeah, there are potentially going to be dozens, Celeste. This debate's going to go on. It's now looking like well beyond New Year's. The Democrats' dream of getting this bill to the president by Christmas time appears to be slipping away, not only because the health care debate is so large, but also there's a debate over jobs that the president wants to inject into the mix here in December, and also, of course, the war. So a couple of speeches today. Tomorrow, the parties meet in their weekly party lunches to map out strategy, which is a lot of amendments, both substantive and maybe clogging amendments, and lots of talk and some votes later this week.
And so, as you say, you're saying it will not be done by the new year?
I don't know that for sure, but judging from the maddening slowness by which the Senate traditionally moves, it's looking less and less likely. The Republicans really want to slow this down. They have the power to do it.
Okay.
Democrats don't have 60 votes for any single approach right now, so the chances of this getting done by
right.
Christmas Eve appear to be slipping away.
Okay, thanks so much. That's the Takeaways. Todd Zwillick.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we
So Family Monday brings us this statistic. Between Thanksgiving and New Year's, 25% of all marriage proposals happen, most of those involving a diamond ring, the symbol of the rock-solid foundation on which to begin a family. But diamonds also finance civil wars around the world. In some places, they symbolize horrific working conditions. How hard is it to find a conflict-free diamond? Takeaway contributor Beth Kobliner and Ibrahim Abdelmateen, our sports contributor, join us. And Beth has some advice for Ibrahim, who, it turns out, is in the market for the right ring for his fiancée this holiday season. Beth, let's start with you. How do you explain the concept of a conflict-free diamond?
Well, it's fascinating. This is the big season, and people are starting to look for diamonds. And I wanted to look into this for Ibrahim, who is engaged and about to be married soon. And it turns out that conflict-free is defined in very different ways by very different people. And basically, if you go into most jewelers, they'll say 99% of our diamonds are conflict-free, but that simply means that the diamonds are not used to fund civil war against recognized governments. So it's not that rebel forces are controlling diamond mines. It has nothing to do with human rights violations, environmental violations, and therein lies the rub. If you want to find a diamond that's from a place that are not abusing people, or they're not those other issues that we've been talking about, then you're going to have to do some homework.
We should note that diamonds come from places that are noted for political instability, Southern Africa, the Sub-Saharan Africa. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, why is this so important to you, getting a conflict-free diamond?
I think it's an important moment. You want to mark this particular moment when you're starting a life. It's an investment, and you don't want to have it to be scarred by anything or tainted by anything that comes from before. I've been very clear that I really would like to have a conflict-free diamond. I don't want to have blood on my hands when I go and get a diamond.
Now, of course, that sounds great, but actually making that happen in practice is very, very difficult. Who did you talk to figure out what the definition of a conflict-free diamond is and how possible it is to get one?
Well, it really ranges from Amnesty International to trying to get in touch with Tiffany, who didn't want to go on air to talk about it. But they, you know, all these manufacturers have and diamond sellers have signed what they call the Kimberley Process, which started in 2003, which basically says that they're going to get diamonds from these conflict-free environments. But then when I checked with, you know, different sources, you hear that conflict-free can mean different things to different people.
Well, what do you make of this definition?
A conflict-free diamond is a rough diamond that is mined in a conflict-free zone or country. And what's important to note is that actually 99.8% of the world's diamonds are, in fact, conflict-free. And the Kimberley Process is something that was developed by the diamond industry, but along with all the governments from diamond-producing countries and the UN to ensure that diamonds were, in fact, traced and that there was a system in place to make sure that diamonds that were being exported and imported were conflict-free and were not going to fund any conflicts.
Now, that's Jamie Cadwell, who's director of the Diamond Information Center. She seems to think everything's just fine.
Right. Well, she does, and that's true. It's a lot better than it was maybe 5-6 years ago. However, even places like Tiffany's and places like Amnesty International are talking about that there are a lot of loopholes and weaknesses in the system. You know, they're talking about the diamond mines and how diamonds are carefully mined. But then when it gets to the next step of polishing and cutting diamonds, it can get other diamonds can get smuggled in. And there's some confusion as to how pure your diamond is when it comes to a conflict-free, completely human rights preserved type of diamond.
Here's a broader definition of a conflict diamond. It comes from Georgette Gagnon, who's Africa director of Human Rights Watch.
A conflict diamond is a diamond that has been mined in circumstances of war or very serious human rights violations. Sometimes they're also called blood diamonds because people have died, had their limbs chopped off, or been killed because of the scramble to mine the diamonds and then make money off them.
One of the complications here is that diamonds, once they leave their place of origin, are very, very difficult to trace.
Exactly. And while some companies have made efforts to try to figure out a way to track them, there's a company in San Francisco, Brilliant Earth, that they particularly specialize in Canadian diamonds. So they can say from start to finish, we know these diamonds are mined in Canada, polished and cut, and we know where they're from, and we can give them to you with that stamp of approval. But then other people say, well, you're taking business away from Africa.
Well, the thing that surprised me, I guess, is that Georgette Gagnon of Human Rights Watch suggests that actually shoppers can beware here. Listen.
The best thing the consumer can do now is when they go to buy a diamond, ask the jeweler for a certificate of origin. Ask the jeweler, where did this diamond come from? And ask the jeweler, can you prove to me that this diamond did not come from, for example, Zimbabwe? And if the jeweler cannot do that, don't buy the diamond.
So, Ibrahim, how did you make up your mind what to do here?
First of all, I went with people who know the industry, and I went to the sort of the back annals of the diamond industry in the diamond district in Manhattan, and I met with some people and appraised some things that I had that I might go to fitting another ring. But part of the problem that I had was finding people that I just felt like were shady. And so I've gone through a number of different steps. I found Brilliant Earth, and I found another shop in Brooklyn that I'm going to go to where it seems like they make things from recycled materials. They get Canadian diamonds. I feel like I want to have a conversation with a human being, and that's the direction that I'm going in.
Have you made a decision?
I have not made a decision. I'm very close, and actually when I leave here today, I'm going to go pick one up, I think.
Do you think it's possible to find a conflict-free diamond that in this strange, kind of very long-standing, you know, global diamond market that you can find something that's pure as a diamond?
I think there is, because I think that, you know, the attitudes of people are changing. People, you know, they always talked about the four C's, cut, clarity, and color of diamonds. Now we're talking about consciousness, and people are saying this is important to them, particularly younger people. You know, people in their 20s and 30s are saying, this is something that means a lot to me. This is something I'm going to have for the rest of my life with my partner for life, and I want to feel comfortable with it.
And 25% of all engagements take place during this holiday season?
Yep.
All right. So we'll look for some conflict-free engagements.
Exactly.
For the holidays. Beth Koblander, thanks so much. And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, good luck.
Thank you.
She has said yes, right?
That's the plan, yes.
She's lovely, too. We're I met her.
Yes.
It's great.
All right. Well, we'll definitely check in on that story. Beth Kobliner, Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, and the very lucky Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor and friend of the Takeaway.
That is the story from Ibrahim and Beth. If you have a story about a conflict-free or conflict-full diamond, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also asking you about your house. The federal program to help homeowners get mortgage loan modifications is not working. So what is working for you, if it is? How are you staying in your home? A second job? Have you drastically cut your budget? Moved to a cheaper place? Let us know at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Memo to the White House. It's not enough.
Hearing your presentation this morning that the recession is over reminds me of a sign I saw one time a couple years ago that said, mission accomplished. It is not happening on the ground.
The mayor of Philadelphia is not buying recession over rhetoric, and he's out to bite the hand holding out federal stimulus cash.
Receive me, brother, you faithless kiss. Leave each other alone like this on the streets of Philadelphia.
They say some banks are too big to fail. The mayor of Philadelphia asks, what about the cities? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
That's right. We have the boss of Philadelphia here on the program. Good morning,
That's
everyone.
Right.
Monday, November 30th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. Coming up, when a boom city goes bust, how far are the repercussions felt? We're talking about Dubai, and the White House crashers are shopping around for an interview. They think they can get $500,000 for their story. We're going to see if that's possible. We're also going to talk to Michael K. Williams. You might know him as Omar from The Wire, but he's also featured in a new movie called The Road.
But first, Bob Henley, WNYC political reporter, joins us. Bob, in cities all over America, the recession has had an impact on services and budgets. What's the next 12 months look like for cities?
John, we can go 36 months, 3-4 years. The National League of Cities survey of municipal finance directors found that 91% are cutting in 2009, laying off thousands or freezing hiring. And then looking ahead to next year, they're going to talk about the same kinds of cuts. And what we see, this is happening as the ride for social services and medical needs continue as the ranks of the long-term unemployed swell. So, you know, we're talking about 82% cuts back forward even to 2010. This is the reason why is that Main Street is based on property taxes is a lagging indicator here. So the decline in the housing market takes a while to work through throughout urban, suburban, and rural municipal entities. And so what ends up happening is they get less of a yield off of the property tax, and now they can't turn to the states because the states say they've got problems too. So they're all looking to Washington.
Well, and there's the structural reason why there's a fundamental inequality between the way cities are experiencing the recession and other places in the U.S. Bob Henley, thanks so much. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk more about impacts on a specific city, Philadelphia, with Mayor Michael Nutter. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
The final showdown over health care legislation begins in the Senate today. The big question, the cost. Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on the ABC program this week.
$2 trillion spending package on health care, $2.5 trillion in the second 10 years, will make premiums go up because taxes go up to pay for it, and we'll never cut Medicare benefits to make it work, nor should we.
Democrats hope to pass a bill before Christmas, but senators from both sides intend to offer some challenging amendments, so that may not happen. In Iran, the White House says Tehran is isolating itself after it announced it would build 10 new uranium enrichment plants. Iran is refusing to comply with the United Nations Nuclear Agency. And police in Seattle are trying to determine if the suspect believed to have killed four officers in a coffee shop ambush has died from his gunshot wounds. They've had a house surrounded for the past few hours where the suspects hold up, and police are trying to communicate with the suspect now.
Treasury Department says only 2,000 people have received permanent home loan modifications, which is a low number considering the stimulus plan set aside $75 billion to help people stay in their homes. President Obama will announce a campaign today to pressure lenders to lower mortgage payments for struggling homeowners. Serena Williams will be returning some money. This tennis star has been hit with the highest Grand Slam fine possible in a two-year probation for her tirade at the U.S. Open. It's a historic fine in the history of professional tennis. The Dow will look to rebound as when it opens at 10,309. The S&P opens just under 1,100 and the NASDAQ at 2,138. We were talking about that federal program, which is supposed to help homeowners stay in their loans. Well, only 2,000 have been helped. Tell us your story. Have you managed to refinance your home, to stay in your house, to keep a roof over your head? We'd love to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Philadelphia's boss, Mayor Michael Nutter, joins us in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. It's a huge issue in America, and Bob Henley, reporter from WNYC here, laid it out right at the top of the hour. Because of the reliance on property taxes, the housing recession dug its fangs deep into American cities all throughout the country. They were first to feel the pain. They're going to be the last to feel the recovery because property values are a lagging indicator. So therefore, cities around the United States perhaps have a special responsibility to get aid from the federal government. When we talk stimulus, who are we really talking about delivering that money to those who are in need? We're joined now, and we're very pleased to be joined by the man at City Hall in the city of Philadelphia, Mayor Michael Nutter of Philadelphia. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Celeste.
And we just want to note our show sends its condolences to the unexpected passing of your father, which really, I suspect, affected your whole Thanksgiving weekend. We're sorry for that, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We were expecting my dad over four Thanksgiving. So, yes, it definitely hit us unexpectedly and very hard. But I appreciate your condolences.
Thank you. And we even more appreciate your joining us this morning because this issue is important to people all over the United States. In Philadelphia, how much has the federal government done to help specifically the types of problems that bear directly on the recession's impact on property values and city budgets and delivery of services?
Well, let me say that while we're deeply appreciative of the American Recovery Act and the great work that President Obama and the Congress did, $787 billion, which is, you know, starting to get out into the streets, for pure city issues and our city budget situation in Philadelphia, we can't use those dollars to plug budget holes. And so we've had to do those things on our own. And I would say to you that that's the case in most cities across the country. Very appreciative of American Recovery Act dollars, but they don't do anything for our budgets. We've had to deal with a $2.4 billion worth of a budget gap over a five-and-a-half-year period, and we've had to solve that on our own. That's been anywhere from layoffs to stopping tax reductions, cutbacks in services and programs, a wide array of actions. So what I refer to as a shared sacrifice series of budget moves, everyone has been affected by this in Philadelphia. And getting people back to work, which of course is the Recovery Act goal, we're getting some dollars out. People are getting trained, folks in solar panel installation and repaving roads, et cetera, but as Tom Cochran from the U.S. Conference of Mayors says, you know, everyone's not going to jump on a backhoe, and everybody's not going to be a solar panel installer.
So, exactly.
Somewhere in between that, I mean, I've had to lay people off. Mayors all across America have had to lay people off. Mayor Bloomberg in New York, Mayor Menino in Boston, Mayor Shirley Franklin in Atlanta. You go down the whole laundry list. Everyone has had the same challenge. And what we're saying is that there are things that the federal government can do. Targeted assistance in areas where you have high unemployment. My unemployment rate in Philadelphia is 11.1%. And unfortunately, will probably continue to grow through 2010.
Well, Mayor, so, I mean, are you making an argument for a return because of this, the severity of this recession to what went on during the Nixon administration and before, block grants where you had unrestricted federal revenues going to cities to do with using their own priorities at the local level?
Well, we have block grant funds right now, community development block grant, community service block grant, CSBG, CDBG. There's the new Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant. There's the COPS program. All grant, all block grant formula based, usually on population or poverty, et cetera, et cetera. That's direct aid
two cities with guidelines, reporting responsibilities, accountability. We know how to do that. And so I'm suggesting here that those programs are good. They just need more funding, and they work. And the federal government knows it, and they've been doing some of these for 30-some-odd years. Transportation is another area. And so those kinds of supports are well known. You can go back to UDAG, or Urban Development Action Grants. One of the hotels in Philadelphia was built with the support of an Urban Development Action Grant, again, also known as UDAGs. Those put people to work in family-sustaining jobs, whether it's on the construction side, but also on the permanent job side. And so cities have a special role to play, cities and metro areas. We heard last year all the discussion about this industry too big to fail, this industry too big to fail.
The banking
cities
industry.
And metro economies are too important to fail. They cannot fail. We don't go out of business. We pay our bills. And so there has to be a reevaluation of the relationship between the cities and the federal government. One of the big challenges is, you know, the president and the Congress, when they have a problem, they just call Treasury Secretary Geithner and say, print more money. We don't print the money in cities.
Well, Mayor, I'm sensing a certain amount of frustration in that while you, in theory, see eye to eye with President Obama, the federal government isn't moving as quickly on urban issues as it has on Treasury issues and dealing with AIG and Goldman Sachs, and that involves real human beings.
Well, it does. I mean, look, I understand you have to stabilize the entire financial system. Without it, where would any of us be? So, I mean, the president has had to systematically and strategically look at how do you deal with these issues. Remember, the bulk of this started while he was still a candidate, and so had no office and no power, and still put forward ideas in a post-election environment, leading to, of course, the economic recovery package. But cities and metro areas need a different kind of assistance than the banking industry, than the auto industry. And those industries, of course, are important. But 80-some-odd percent of the American public lives in a city or a metro area. In order for the president to accomplish his goal of saving or creating 3 to 4 million jobs, that will only happen in cities,
right,
and metro regions, metro economies.
At what point, and this is a final question, you won by a huge majority, a huge landslide in Philadelphia. At what point does your political constituency become threatened by lack of action on the part of the federal government?
Well, I think you'll see, whether it's in Philadelphia or any other city across the country, I mean, the citizenry is still pretty angry, mad, and confused about what's going on. And again, on the ground, we've had to make some very, very tough decisions. I mean, every program, every service we have has a constituency. And someone's been upset by actions that I've had to take and other mayors. So as we saw earlier this year, this was a tough year politically for incumbents to run. And we saw certainly some upset races. You know, none of us created this. I mean, I'm a mayor of a city. I mean, my primary job is, you know, having officers on the street to make the street safe. We pick up trash. We fill potholes. I mean, I didn't lend anybody any money. I didn't create derivatives.
Right.
But when the public is angry, they take it out on their elected officials. I mean, you know, this is, you know, I'm not running a banking system here.
No, he's the mayor, Michael Nutter of Philadelphia. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some of the top stories we're following.
Police in Seattle have been doing what they can to communicate with a man they believe shot dead four police officers yesterday. They've been trying to talk to Maurice Clemens using loudspeakers, explosions, and even a robot. Clemens is supposedly holed up inside a house. At one point this morning, gunshots were heard. It's unclear what condition the suspect is in. The Senate will debate health care today. Expect some serious horse trading over the next few days. The Democratic leadership wants to pass this bill before the end of the year. And in international news, John Demjanjuk, a 89-year-old retired auto worker from Ohio, is now on trial in Germany. He's charged with being an accessory to the murder of almost 30,000 Jews at a Nazi death camp during World War II. The case has taken 30 years to come to trial.
Here in the United States, Florida Highway Patrol continues to investigate the Friday crash involving golfer Tiger Woods, who's rejected three attempts by troopers to interview him so far. Woods has issued a statement taking responsibility for the crash, but he describes it as, quote, a private matter. Coming up, it's a great gig if you can crash a White House dinner and get $500,000. Well, the couple of aspiring reality TV stars are trying to peddle their experience for $500,000. We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. First, go to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So the health care debate starts today. There's a lot of amendments that are going to be proposed beginning tomorrow. How long is this amendment process expected to take?
Dozens of amendments, Celeste. Democrats were hopeful to get this bill off the floor by Christmas time. It's looking increasingly unlikely that that can happen. There are a lot of issues roiling around health care. We've been talking about them. Of course, the public option. You can't forget about Medicare, the overall cost of the bill, and by the way, abortion. The key on the health care debate right now is that there don't appear to be 60 votes for any approach. So that means a lot of negotiation and a lot of horse trading and a lot of voting before Harry Reid can find a way off the floor with this bill. It's unclear at this point.
Okay, so let's move on to the job summit. There's going to be a White House job summit at the end of the week. Many people are saying this is just going to be a photo opportunity. Is it just all staging, or is it something expected to come out of the summit?
Well, the White House end of things may be staging and a photo opportunity, but the president has also said he wants Congress to act quickly on a jobs bill. Democrats are extremely nervous about 10.2% unemployment. You know, take them at their word. That's bad for people, and they're concerned about it. Fine. They're also concerned about themselves. You can't win an election in 2010 with unemployment this high. So they're looking at a bill that may have tax cuts for businesses to hire people, certainly extensions for unemployment insurance, maybe some spending on highways and infrastructure. The one tough part about this, though, is that Harry Reid in the Senate can't get onto a jobs bill that the president wants without 60 votes because he's on the health care bill now. So it's unclear how they get that done before Christmas.
Okay. And they're also going to hear Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke coming to Capitol Hill to defend his handling of the economy.
Fed chairman and punching bag this week. There's a lot of frustration on the Hill and out there in America about the economy. Ben Bernanke needs to be reconfirmed for his second term as Fed chairman. He has a confirmation hearing on Thursday, Celeste. There's a lot of angry senators with angry constituents, and you can bet that they're going to project a lot of their anger about the economy right onto Bernanke on Thursday.
Okay, thanks so much. Three big things to watch for this week. Todd Zwillick is our Washington correspondent.
And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor, joins us. It was a balmy week in New York, but boy, for basketball fans, it's going to be a cold winter. A little history in the NBA is made over the weekend. You've got the longest losing streak by the New Jersey Nets in the history of the NBA.
Well, they matched the longest losing streak. And if they lose another one, then they're going to be going down in the infamous part of NBA history for sure.
And they're competing with the hapless Knicks, who are already as bad as they can possibly be.
The Knicks are having one of the worst starts of their franchise, and then they're stringing together the longest stretch of non-playoff appearances ever in the history of the Knicks.
And anybody who follows the NBA these days is not surprised by any of this. The Nets and the Knicks, they stink.
It's true.
But the interesting history for me is this Twitter story out of the NBA.
One second, John. I just have to Twitter this real quick. One second.
So Twittering in the middle of a game. It's actually a story.
Mark Cuban last March was fined $25,000 for Twittering. And
he's the owner of the Dallas Mavericks.
Correct. They fined him $25,000. So this $7,500 that they fined Phoenix Suns, Amari Stoudemire, and the Charlotte Bobcats for Tyson Chandler, the $7,500 that they fined each of them for tweeting during the game on Wednesday in halftime. So I think the fines are worth it, but
Wait a minute, though. I think the NBA is like missing the boat here. This is like an opportunity for them. Why are they cracking down on the players? Of course you want to get a Twitter from Shaq in the middle of the game.
I think it's message control. And the other thing it's connected to is when players go on trips, they wear suits and ties. And some teams have specific dress codes, so it's similar to that dress code. It's their modicum of how they're supposed to present themselves as an NBA player.
I don't know. It seems to me like maybe an opportunity is being lost here. You can't stop the 21st century, even if you're the NBA. But it's an interesting story. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor. Thanks so much.
Hey, good morning.
And now a takeout on media and reality shows stars. Brian Stelter's joined us. He writes the Media Decoder blog for our partner, The New York Times. Here's the story. The couple that crashed President Obama's White House dinner is not talking about it unless they're paid. Tarek and Michaela Salahi canceled their tonight's interview with Larry King, and they're asking for up to $500,000 to do an interview about the incident. Brian, big news networks generally do not pay people to interview them.
They do not, and I think they especially generally do not pay for an interview like this. An interview that, you know, a week from now, a month from now, hopefully we're not even going to remember this story. So to expect $500,000 for it seems fanciful in some ways.
Someone will probably pay $500,000, though, right?
You know, it's possible that one of these, you know, supermarket tabloids might pay something, but I think $500,000 is a stretch for anybody. You know, I think if we see them on NBC, it'll be an indication that this couple is going to show up on Bravo after all. As we know, they've been contending for the Real Housewives of D.C. If they end up on NBC, I think that's an indication they actually are going to get a show. They're actually going to get on the show. But you know, the more people I talk to this weekend, the more it seems like they're not going to actually show up on this show ever.
Nobody's really going to care. You know, this and the Balloon Boy incident are just reminders to us of how reality shows are really influencing reality, everyone's real life. Is there an end to the American appetite for reality shows and the people who appear on them?
You know, according to the ratings, there's not. But I'd like to see an ombudsman, you know, for these shows. This was suggested over the weekend on a website called The Wrap. An ombudsman that can make sure the casting's not getting out of hand. Because lately we've had some kind of scary incidents where casting's gone awry on these shows. And maybe what we need is a little bit more, some sort of standards that are applied when it comes to picking the contestants for these shows.
I love that, Brian. Someone in Hollywood whose job it is to determine what is real reality.
And who's a normal person to be cast on the show and who is not? Brian Stelter writes the Media Decoder blog for our partner, the New York Times. $500,000.
We'll pay it. Well, why don't we just say, sure, we'll pay you $500,000. Come on the show. Come on. And then
we don't have $500,000.
Well, then we won't pay them.
Then
what
they
can they
come
do?
On the
what
show.
Are they going to do? What are they going to do? It's a reality
show. What are they
going to
talk about anyway? They're just going to talk about walking through the White House and shaking people's hands. Yeah. I don't want to do that in my own life.
It's a reality show called The Takeaway. We'll just have it on.
I don't know.
We'll pay you.
No more reality show,
please.
We'll
do a pledge drive.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, where Dubai goes, so does the rest of the world. More on what it means when a city halfway across the world goes bust. That's in a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. News reports say the White House is trying to build a stronger relationship with Pakistan. The Washington Post this morning says President Obama wrote a letter to Pakistan's president this month where he offered to forge a new strategic partnership with Pakistan to increase trade and military cooperation. Police in Seattle say the suspect, believed to have killed four officers in a coffee shop ambush yesterday, is wounded and may be dead. They've had a house surrounded for the past few hours where the suspect was holed up. They're trying to communicate with him now. And the battle begins today in the Senate to overhaul the nation's health care. So far, the 60 votes needed don't appear to be there, so expect some intense debates.
Top finance official in Dubai says the debts of Dubai World are not guaranteed by the Emirates government. He also says lenders bear some responsibility for the crisis because they should have known there were no government bailouts on the horizon. Markets are open at this hour and are mulling over the situation in Dubai. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down marginally in the early going. More on the Dubai story in just a moment. It's the biggest gamble so far for the city of Las Vegas. The city is opening the $8.5 billion, 67-acre, six-tower City Center Complex in the heart of the Las Vegas Strip. State leaders hope the complex leads Nevada out of 2 years of economic misery. Well, maybe they should look to Dubai. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Speaking of Dubai, Dubai was one of those cities that kind of represented all the profligacy of the past 10 years or so, but now they're asking for a six-month extension on $60 billion in loans. And in response, Dubai's and Abu Dhabi's main stock market slumped this morning. We were joined earlier by BBC's Middle East business reporter Jeremy Howells in Dubai. We asked him if there had been a bank run in Dubai, as some had feared.
No, the bank run didn't happen. I've been around the city this morning, and there aren't long queues of people behind banks. That's queuing up to get their money out. That's because the central bank here in the United Arab Emirates moved very quickly to set up a special fund to reimburse any banks which had losses through Dubai World's non-payment of debt. And that reassured the depositors at banks that that you know, there wasn't any danger. And so that's one problem which has been averted. You're talking about the slumps on the stock exchanges here.
Right.
In the first few minutes of trading at 10 o'clock our time, Dubai Financial Market instantly fell 7%. Abu Dhabi Securities Exchange fell by 8%. And the worst sectors hit, were the banks and property development companies. The banks, because people didn't know who had exposure to Dubai World's debt, which it wants to put on standstill. The property development companies, because, of course, they're the ones which need credit. They're the ones which need credit to build all of Dubai's towers. And of course, with Dubai's credibility injured, it's unlikely that they're going to get so much cash in the future.
Well, you're there, Jeremy. What is the mood there? Are people sort of in anxious waiting mode at this point?
Yeah, it splits two ways. You must know that, I mean, there's so much of Dubai is made up of expatriates, either from Europe or North America or from Southeast Asia. And the mood amongst them is they're very, very worried about whether, you know, they're going to lose their jobs, whether Dubai is going to collapse economically over the past year. Some of them very pessimistic, but others thinking, well, you know, Dubai is still a strong economy. It can pull through this. Oh. As far as the Emiratis are concerned, they're extremely angry. They think the whole of this crisis has been sensationalized. They think they don't deserve this bad publicity. They think that there's a conspiracy going on in the Western world to knock it off its pedestal, mostly out of jealousy.
Okay, that's the BBC's Middle East business reporter Jeremy Howells joining us from Dubai. For more details on this story and to help us understand really what's going on, we're joined by Landon Thomas, financial correspondent for our partners, The New York Times. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
So, first of all, let me ask you how connected Dubai is with the rest of the world. If Dubai, they've warned they need an extension on, the Dubai world needs an extension on their loans, their $60 billion worth of debt. If they end up in default, how does that affect us here in the United States?
Well, let's put it this way. It's not a Lehman Brothers by any extent, and it's not like the subprime crisis where you had a plague of toxic securities just going throughout the world. It's fairly localized. It's a big problem in Dubai, and it's a big problem for broad confidence within the region. But banks, mostly European, have about $130 billion exposure there, and that's just really a drop in the great pool of bank assets around the world. So it's not something that's going to explode the world financial system like Lehman Brothers did. What it will do, though, is create this uncertainty on the part of investors, one that was already growing before this happened, about the ability of indebted governments all over the world to pay what they owe. And that could be a country in Europe like Greece, could be in Italy, it could be other emerging markets with big debt burdens like Latvia. But it creates this sense of surprise, because this was a shock in the end that, well, in some cases, maybe some governments or quasi-governments can't pay their debts. And that's something shocking for investors all around the world, because this is a system that's based on trust, and that's been rattled to some extent.
And you have the added dimension of oil, Landon Thomas, a financial correspondent for The New York Times. I mean, Dubai doesn't have oil itself, but it's so bound up with the Emirates. Are we seeing the limits of oil-based sovereign wealth funds to bail out extravagant projects like Dubai?
Dubai doesn't. It built this whole city on debt, and its neighboring emirate, Abu Dhabi, which is also sort of runs the UAE, is the one that has the oil. So when the bailout comes, and to some extent it will come, it'll come from Abu Dhabi. But yeah, I think there is a sense that you just can't spend and build willy-nilly forever, and then when it doesn't work out, go and say, well, we got a problem here. I mean, it's kind of like General Motors, and that to some extent it's management, it's strategy, and the people in charge have to take the consequences. And I think that's what you're going to see in Dubai that Abu Dhabi, which runs the show, is going to extract a pound of flesh from Dubai, as well as the bankers, because they were all in this together.
Well, we're talking in Dubai about an economy that's an $80 billion economy that's founded almost completely, as we alluded to, on tourism and real estate and the bet that they'll become a financial center. So if that's not going to happen, if they don't become a tourist center, if the Dubai world does not succeed, what does Dubai fall back on?
Well, I think it's not going to be an apocalypse, because there really is enough in the end in the area and Abu Dhabi to sort of keep this thing afloat. They're just going to have to take a step back, and they can't just keep on putting up apartment buildings based on debt just for the sake of putting up apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. That's basically what has been going on here. And so I think they'll pare down like most of the world has done. Whether you're a consumer or a house or a homeowner, you're going to pare down. Doesn't mean you go away, but you'll have to sort of restrain and pull back. And that hasn't happened yet in Dubai, and it's going to have to happen. But Dubai, as a center, as a commercial center, as a financial center, will still be there. It'll just be perhaps a little bit more humble.
Right. Landon Thomas, financial correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, joining us from London. Thanks so much. An early look at the U.S. market reaction. The markets opened a little under 10 minutes ago, and it looks like reaction is mostly flat. Coming up in a few minutes, from The Wire to The Road, actor Michael K. Williams joins us to talk about his roles where it isn't really clear who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. He's going to join us later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Are radical Islamists plotting to take over America from the inside? And are there interns strategically placed in Congress in order to replace the U.S. Constitution with Sharia law? Well, a congressman out of North Carolina believes those things are true, and Representative Sue Myrick is leading the fight now to warn us about what she calls the Muslim mafia. Myrick would be a much simpler person, actually. She was just prejudiced against Muslims, but that's not the case. Julie Rose can explain this to us. She's a reporter with WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Julie, good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So, Sue Myrick, explain the character of this congresswoman for us, because I think she kind of represents a certain population in the United States. She is convinced there is a Muslim mafia that is plotting to take over the United States and put the U.S. under Sharia law.
Right. And a mafia, not so much in terms of, like, you know, people out there with a hit on others or whatever, organized crime, but really this idea that they want to convert people to a radical ideology and launch terror threats here on our home soil. So Sue Myrick is interesting. She's a Republican from Charlotte. She's been in office since 95. After 9/11, she founded the House Anti-Terror Caucus because she became convinced of this threat. She's now on the House Intelligence Committee, so she's getting a lot of inside briefings. And she really believes this is even a bigger threat than she even thought a couple of years ago.
Okay, so here's what Sue Myrick has to say about whether or not she's trying to make people in her district scared of Muslims.
It's not a matter of trying to instill fear in people that they should look at every Arab or every Muslim or everybody who looks different than they do with suspicion and fear. We're just saying, hey, you need to be aware that there are terrorist cells here, that there are people operating who do want to do us harm in our country.
So what she's doing is she's pointed to certain things. In Raleigh, North Carolina, there were the seven guys accused of a homegrown terror plot. We had the homegrown terror plot out of Colorado, and now the incident at Fort Hood. She's taking these completely isolated, unrelated incidents and turning this into what she believes is a movement. Is that relatively accurate?
Yep, she likes to call it connecting the dots. And every time an incident like this happens, she'll send out press releases. And even when there's not one, she'll send out every couple of weeks, it seems, a press release talking about Islamo-fascist infiltrators and radical Islamists who are trying to take over. And like she says, it's not about fear. I mean, what she claims is that she's actually trying to draw the distinction. And she's always careful to say these are a small minority of the Muslims in America. And she now is kind of focusing on how she's trying to give the moderate Muslims, as she calls them, the mainstream, more of a voice. She wants them to get kind of active in coming out against this these terror activities and try to really put themselves up. But the words that she uses are troubling to a lot of Muslims.
Well, here's Salahuddin Hassan, a Charlotte area Muslim, talking about that very thing.
Muslim mafia, come on, man. Just stop using that language. That language needs to be canned. Because I'm a Muslim, and see, we all done been lumped together. You got my kufi on in the grocery store. You look at me out the corner of your eye when you see me. Oh, this guy got a bun. This guy may have something. You better watch him. That's what they're doing. This is not good.
Very, very quickly, the Muslim population in North Carolina, they are supporters or they don't know what to do with her?
They don't think she's a friend, typically. But interestingly, recently she just sat down with, for the first time in a year or so, with some local Muslim leaders. And they actually came away kind of convinced that maybe she is trying to help. And there are Muslims out there who think she's right.
Well, we'll see how that goes. Julie Rose is a reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Friend or foe in North Carolina with Sue Myrick.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. The movie The Road, which opened over the weekend, is a survival tale about a post-apocalyptic world. Michael K. Williams is one of its stars, and he joins us for a discussion of survival on and off the screen. You may know him from The Wire. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Police surrounding a home in Seattle believe that the suspect in the shooting deaths of four police officers over the weekend is inside. He's wounded and possibly dead. They've been trying to communicate with suspect Maurice Clemens using loudspeakers, explosions, and even a robot. On Capitol Hill, the Senate will start debating the health care bill today. The Democratic leadership is keen to pass it before the end of the year. Our Todd Zwillick says that's doubtful.
A member of the House panel that oversees the Secret Service says the security lapse that allowed a couple to crash a White House state dinner last Tuesday is unforgivable and must be corrected. Republican Congressman Peter King is calling for an investigation of the incident. And it was a record-breaking Thanksgiving holiday at the box office. Over the past 5 days, about $278 million was spent on movie tickets.
That's
beats
a lot of cranberries.
Last record of $245 million that was set in 2000. That's a look at some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So throughout the movie The Road, which opened last week in theaters around the country, there are small scenes of very grim survival.
I knew this was coming. This was something like it. You were the last man left alive.
How would you know that? That you were the last man alive?
Well, I guess you know it. You just feel it.
The Road stars Viggo Mortensen, Charlize Theron, and Robert Duvall. It's based on the best-selling novel by Cormac McCarthy, in which a father and a son journey to escape thieves and modern-day cannibals. And along the way, a young boy asks, who are the good guys and the bad guys in this post-apocalyptic world? Experienced actor Michael K. Williams has a gripping cameo in this survival movie, and he's used to playing characters who are a complex mix of good and bad. Michael, are you one of the good guys in this movie?
He's a good guy that makes a bad decision.
All he's called in the script is the thief.
It's ironic because, you know, if any other one of the characters was in that situation, or any one of those people in that story was in that situation, they probably would have done the same thing. It says a lot about his character because, like you just mentioned, there are this cannibalism going
on.
Yeah,
oh, it's nasty.
And the fact that he sees this little young, subtle little piece of meat laying there just totally defenseless and doesn't even touch him, just, you know, just picks up the things that he feels he needs for himself, says a lot about his character.
Well, nobody does it like you, I should say. And many people know you as Omar from the hit series The Wire. Michael Williams, welcome to our studio.
Thank you.
As you mentioned there, you play this thief in the road who comes upon a defenseless little boy in the middle of all this bleakness, steals everything but leaves the boy.
Mm-hmm.
And your reward for that is to have everything stolen from you, and Viggo Mortensen and the boy reluctantly leave you standing naked there on a cold, gray, horrible looking road.
You said bad decision. Good guy made a bad decision. What I see most in that scene is you get to see the boy become a man. That's the first time he challenges Papa,
right,
and stands up for what he believes in, whether Papa agrees with it or not, and stands his ground. So,
well, we get to see you too. I mean, that snapshot of somebody who thought he'd escaped, who then is left completely powerless and probably dead, is the kind of role I think we know you for.
I definitely want to rise to the occasion. I was in some damn good company.
Yeah, you know, Viggo Mortensen,
yeah,
Robert
man.
Duvall.
And Cody. That young man is a prodigy. Expect to see a lot of great things from him, man. He's a great kid and just a dynamic thespian. But, I seem to have these moments. You know, I guess I'm drawn to darker characters than others. I don't know why I do them so well.
You come by it rightly.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's what I've heard.
I'm not complaining, that's for sure.
Well, The Road is an incredible movie. I saw it over the weekend. Really incredible, fantastic work. Let's talk about The Wire for a moment. There's a place that is bleak in a sense, but the whole motivation from the series, it seems, was to present life in Baltimore in a way that people might understand and get something good out of it. Do you feel that The Wire's bleakness on screen is belied by the sort of repercussions that the series has had?
I think The Wire is a lot bigger than a Baltimore story. I think it's an American story, and it just happened to take place in Baltimore. And that story, that series is presenting itself as a voice for a lot of people that go unheard normally.
So, but it's a social document, and a professor at Harvard has started teaching The Wire.
Yeah, Professor Ogletree.
It doesn't surprise you.
That was a big surprise, I'm not going to lie. We just came from Harvard,
right.
And I got a chance to lecture alongside Professor Wilson and Professor Ogletree. It was that was a real treat. But it doesn't really surprise me that it would make that type of a response. Because that's what it deals with. That's what David and Ed, that was what they wanted to do from the very beginning. It wasn't just for entertainment or just to tell this what's going on in Baltimore. This is what's going on in the country, in every city.
How's your mom doing in Brooklyn?
My mom's doing fine. She's not in Brooklyn anymore. She's left the state. She's in Pennsylvania.
Well, what does she think of you lecturing at Harvard?
You really don't want to know. It's not pretty.
Really?
It's not pretty. She tells me to just smile and don't talk too much. She doesn't consider me the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Is that right? You don't get any breaks, do you?
Nah.
None.
No.
Well, that's probably good. What do you think it is about your sort of ability to connect with emotions inside of you that makes you perfect for The Wire and perfect for this tiny scene, really, in The Road?
You know, I don't know. I guess I give some of it to my upbringing. You know, I was never the thug. I was never the cool guy. But for some reason, I all my friends, they always kind of like those were the majority of my friends who I kept were thugs and cool guys. And I think pretty much they just they allowed me to be a part of the circles because I didn't pretend to be anything that I wasn't. You know, I stayed in my lane and I just did what I could do. You know, which was I liked to have fun. I was always the life of the party, and that was pretty much it. And so I think my sensitivity that I was raised with in me, alongside what I was allowed to see and be around growing up in Vanderveer, I guess you mix those two things. I understand where these dark characters come from. You know, people might look at them at first glance and be like, oh my God, they're so frightening. I would look at them and be like, nah, they just misunderstood. You know, so I guess I have an end to both worlds.
Give us a sense of where you started and where you are now.
You know, well, on a personal level, I had no direction growing up earlier in life. Like, pretty much through my 20s, I had a real knack for just making the wrong decision. Now that I've been blessed to support myself in this business, I've gotten a little more mature, gotten, you know, more responsible with the blessings that's been given to me, and I don't want to screw this up because there is no plan B.
Right. There is no, that's great. Yeah, for me either. But you know what's puzzling to me is that, you know, there's so many people, and, you know, I live in Brooklyn. We both live in Brooklyn. I mean, you can find a lot of kind of distracted, messed up kids who want to be a star or have some sort of half-hearted plan to go on TV or to be a hip-hop artist or something. For them, the arts aren't something that pulls them together. It's something that's part of a kind of a distracted day-to-day existence. How come the arts pulled you together as opposed to just being another distraction?
First of all, that you said it right. That was the answer in your question right there. You have people who want to become a star, and then you have people who want to get into the arts. You know, I love the craft. I love the work that goes into preparing. I love the rehearsal process. I love everything about what's not sexy about the business, you know, the star aspect of it. That was like a cherry on the cake. I didn't even think that I would even, you know, that was not on my radar to become a star. I just wanted to do something that I enjoyed doing and that I thought I was good at. This was the first thing that I found that held my attention, and I loved it.
Well, thank you for joining us, Michael K. Williams. The Road opened in theaters nationwide last week, and where you can see his brief but powerful performance as the thief. You should check that movie out. Also, Michael is going to stick around. We'd like him to do some video and introduce our listeners to the little dog he's been holding during this whole interview. Brooklyn is the name of the dog. He's been chilling out. He's got a very handsome down jacket. You want to check that out. We'll post the video at thetakeaway.org.
While you're at the website, catch up on anything that you missed today. You can get your podcast subscription at thetakeaway.org. Today, we're asking you about your home. The federal program to help homeowners get mortgage loan modifications is not working, and we're getting your takes.
My name is Victoria, and I'm from Marlborough, Massachusetts. I'm in a terrible fix with losing my home and also terrible increased hardship due to physical lack of health. Extreme cost of that. I have very little money left. I'm going to lose my home.
It's tough for a lot of people, and we're wondering, how are you getting by? How are you staying in your home? Have you taken a second job? Are you making some severe cuts in your own budget? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You know how to reach us. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.